This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Captain Cook was advanced a few paces before the Marines when they fired. The stones flew as thick as hail, which knocked the lieutenant down, and as he was rising, a fellow struck him in the back with a spear. However, he recovered himself, shot the Indian dead, and escaped into the water. Captain Cook was now the only man on the rock. He was seen walking down towards the pinnace, holding his left hand against the back of his head to guard it from the stones and carrying his musket under the other arm. An Indian came running behind, stopping once or twice as he advanced, as if he was afraid that he should turn around, and then, taking him unaware, he sprung at him, knocked him on the back of the head with a large club, and instantly fled with the greatest precipitation. The blow made Captain Cook stagger two or three paces. He then fell on his hand and one knee and dropped his musket, and as he was rising, another Indian came running to him, and before he could recover himself from the fall, drew out an iron dagger he concealed under his feathered cloak and stuck it with all his force into the back of his neck, which made Captain Cook tumble into the water. It was February 14, 1779, and a few moments later, Captain Cook was dead. I think just as that particular description of the end of Captain Cook is a very dramatic ending, I think it posed a problem for Europe, in the sense that this person, this man who had been so instrumental for the past 11 years in exploring the Pacific, was suddenly no more. And I think that some of the idea of the shock and horror which occurred in Kalakaua Bay was that the people who survived the skirmish actually left Cook's body and that of the other Marines, the four Marines who were also killed, on the beach. There was just simply a moment of total blankness, if you like, a great shock. So what we have in the next few days is we have the two vessels, the Resolution and the Discovery, still at anchor in Kalakaua Bay. And gradually there is a return to some sort of normality, if that's possible. The remains of Captain Cook, some flesh and a few of the bones, were returned to the Resolution, and gradually the work to the foremast and the Resolution was completed as well, so that the vessel could finally leave the bay, which it did about a week later. And on the 21st, 7 days after the massacre, Cook's remains were interred in Kalakaua Bay and given all due respects. The problem for people back in Europe, of course, was that without a body, it was very hard to mourn Cook. And I think that is a problem which confronted historians too, trying to commemorate his name and his memory in some appropriate fashion. This wonderful little ditty box, which is in the State Library of New South Wales, is an example of how the crew of the Resolution went about trying to express their feelings. This was carved out of timber from the Resolution, and you'll see that it has a lock of Cook's hair in it, and also it has a little image there, a painting of Kalakaua Bay, the rocky point where Cook was killed. And also with the various plaques there, it refers to the places where Cook was most renowned in his work. So his work in Quebec when he was a very young officer, doing soundings in the St. Lawrence River, which allowed the British to take Quebec. His work in Newfoundland when he really honed his skills as a surveyor. And then some of the other places he was. With the little ditty box here, it's an example of, I think, the crew providing something for Mrs. Cook. On the sides of the box, there's an inscription which says, "Made of Resolution Oak for Mrs. Cook of the crew." The vessels then continued north through the Hawaiian group, continued on under Clark in command at this point, and news of Cook's death finally came across overland, across from Russia, across to London, and finally arrived in London in January in 1780. And of course, it caused great consternation. This is an example of one of the effects that news had. This is a short elegy which was written by Mrs. Seward, or Miss Seward at the time. And you'll get some idea of the very raised feelings at that time. This is from the last verse of that elegy. O raise thy thoughts to yonder starry plain, and own thy sorrow selfish, weak and vain, since wild Britannia, in his virtues just, twines the bright wreath and rears the immortal bust, while on each wind of heaven his fame shall rise in endless incense to the smiling skies, the attendant power that bade his sails expand and waft her blessings to each barren land, now raptured bears him to the mortal plains, where mercy hails him with congenial strains, where soars on joy's white plume his spirit free, and angels choir him while he waits for thee. Now, while this might have been a very nice way to remember Cook, I hardly think that it gives us any real information, and I don't think it's an entirely appropriate commemoration of Cook. I think just as people were shocked after the death of Cook in Hawaii, it took some time back in England for people to come to terms with this death. The Royal Society in 1784 attempted to commemorate the death of Cook by producing this commemorative medal in bronze, silver and in gold. This particular one here is one of the silver examples. And one of these was donated or presented to Mrs. Cook, along with an amount of £200 and an annuity, which was settled on Elizabeth Cook by George III. So, in the absence of Cook, there was a great attempt to support Mrs. Cook, the survivor of this great man. People like Sir Hugh Palliser, who had been so instrumental in Cook's career, he also erected a monument to Cook at his own estate in Buckinghamshire, where he had an inscription: to the memory of James Cook, the ablest navigator this or any other country hath produced. George III also, in 1785, allowed a coat of arms, an armorial coat of arms, for the Cook family. So there are all these various attempts by people to find an appropriate way of commemorating Cook. There's also, at this time, various people coming out with lives of Cook, trying to piece together enough information. And, of course, there was a very ready market. People wanted to know not only how Cook had died, which, of course, was very gory, spectacular, had all the good requirements of a great story, but people also then wanted to know more about this man's early life. So one of the earliest examples we have of somebody trying to knit together some sort of a biography is the work put together by George Christoph Lichtenberg in 1780. Lichtenberg, the German intellectual and philosopher, used sources from a number of places. Apart from Johann Reinhold Forster, he also used information from newspapers and also information from Lieutenant John Rickman, a German-speaking officer on that Resolution voyage. Now, the standard process when people came back on these voyages was that any journals they had were confiscated by the commander, because really it was these were all the property of the Admiralty, and they didn't want any unofficial accounts coming out. In Rickman's case, he was able, because he spoke German, to keep his journal or his notes in German, and so they escaped the net. In 1781, there was also an account, Reis um die Welt mit Captain Cook, which was produced by Heinrich Zimmermann, an able seaman, on the Discovery. And in that case, the Admiralty actually suppressed the publication, and there was no English version of that until 1926. Again, we have another account by an American, John Ledyard, who was one of the Marine corporals on the Resolution, who produced an account in 1783. But really, there was no official account of anything to do commemorating Cook's life, until the official account of the third voyage was finally published in 1784. That was the account edited by the Reverend John Douglas, the Canon of Windsor, where he brought together the account of Cook's journal up to the time of his death in 1779, and then added to it the account of King, who had brought the discovery back to England. Now, there'd also been all sorts of problems with the engravings. All of the various of accounts of Cook, the Hawkesworth's version, Douglas's second account, and finally the third account, were always very rich in engravings. And one of the problems with Cook's death was that there was a lot of information out there, but there was a need to consolidate charts, the work of the various artists, along with the appropriate journals to create the official account, and this all took time. So it was in 1784, four and a bit years after Cook's death, that this account finally comes out. And it's that, really, which sparks George Forster to describe the introduction to that third voyage, the introduction written by John Douglas, as being intolerable. And what I want to look at now is some of the reasons as to why he might have regarded that as being intolerable. This portrait of Captain Cook by Nathaniel Dance was done after the second voyage, and the second voyage is the one on which both Reinald Forster and George Forster sailed with Cook. And you can see that Cook has his hand on a chart here. We'll see the chart in a moment. But in many ways, I believe the second voyage was the most arduous, a voyage which took the Resolution and the Adventure down into Antarctic waters, the Resolution down into areas as far as 71 degrees south, dodging icebergs, incredibly cold conditions where the crew, the only protection they had were Fearnought jackets, very heavy felt jackets. And I think if anybody was going to see Cook in his true light, this was a time when Cook was really at the height of his powers in what I think was the most arduous of all his voyages. And so it's interesting that George Forster should at a later time decide to write about this voyage. So some of the reasons why Forster might think that Douglas's account was intolerable. Well, of course, at the end of the adventure, the Endeavour voyage, Cook had returned to England, but it had been really very much a triumph for Sir Joseph Banks. It was Sir Joseph Banks who was lionised in the press. And although Cook was promoted to commander, and he very quickly went about being involved in the planning for the second voyage, it was very much Banks's show. And so when planning had progressed to a certain point with the second voyage, Lord Sandwich, who at that time was the First Sea Lord in charge of the Admiralty, invited Banks to come back and to go on the second voyage with Cook. And Banks, of course, could hardly say no. He would be expected by the public, the anticipation of yet another great adventure that he should be involved in. Well, Banks took to the planning with great gusto, to a point where he took over, to a large extent, control of changes to the accommodation on the Resolution. The Resolution, of course, had been chosen by Cook. Again, it was a collier, a larger collier than the Endeavour initially. But Banks, of course, had been unhappy throughout the first voyage. He'd felt that the accommodation in the great cabin was very small, very tight, and if he was going to go on to another voyage, particularly into such difficult conditions down in the Antarctic, he certainly wanted to have far better arrangements, particularly as he planned to have a group of 17 people, 17 supernumeraries, not only he and Sir Lander, but also Dr. James Lind, who was to act as a naturalist, various draftsmen, but also a horn player, just to keep him entertained. So we have this period in 1772 from about November through to April where the Resolution is in Deptford in the dockyard undergoing very large renovations. And the plans, which are now in the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, the plans they have show the vessel in the state showing these changes. And what you see is that the vessel is simply getting taller and taller. The superstructure is being built up higher and higher. And whereas you might expect initially to have had a quarter deck, now there's another layer, a roundhouse, which for all that name is actually a square cabin, stuck on top of the quarter deck. Now what this does is it from a engineering point of view, it actually raises the centre of balance. And so when the vessel finally was ready to go down the Thames to undergo sea trials, it was found to be entirely top-heavy. It was crank, as they say. It wouldn't sail worth a farthing. And throughout this process, Cook had been very much aware of what was going on. The Navy Board, who was in charge of these changes, had kept up a conversation, a dialogue with the Admiralty, saying these are dangerous things to be doing to this vessel. But it wasn't until the proof was in the pudding that the vessel tried to sail down the Thames and down to the Downs that the vessel was shown to be so top-heavy that it was totally dangerous. It was not going to be able to go anywhere very far, and certainly not down into the Southern Ocean. So in May, things came to a head. The vessel at that stage was back in harbour, and an ultimatum was put. Cook said, this vessel is unseaworthy. Banks said, well, this is the way I want it. And at that time, both the Admiralty and the Navy Board supported Cook. Banks pulls out. He says, well, if it's not going to be that way, well, I'm simply not going on this expedition. And at that point, we have an opportunity for Johan Reinald Forster and his son to enter the fray. Descended from a Yorkshireman who had emigrated to Danzig in the middle of the 17th century, Johan Reinald Forster was born just outside that city in 1729. He showed an early gift for languages, which he studied formally, along with classical and biblical studies at school in Berlin, before attending the Friedrichs University of Hull, where he enrolled in theological studies, but showed a greater interest in natural history. In 1753, he was ordained and sent to the parish of Nassenhuben, where he remained as pastor and developed scholarly interests in geography and ancient civilizations over the following 12 years. He married in 1754, and his son George, the first of eight children, was born later in the same year. Forster corresponded widely, and his skill for languages brought him to the attention of influential people at the court of Catherine the Great in 1765. In that year, he travelled with George to St. Petersburg, where he received a commission to investigate and report on the fledgling settlements of German immigrants Catherine was attempting to establish along the Volga. The commission went badly. Forster was thorough in his work, and instead of producing a report which would encourage more Germans to migrate, as expected by the Russian authorities, his report was a starkly honest appraisal which alienated his Russian employer. When his demands for payment were refused, he and his son left for England, where they arrived in October 1766 with little money but great resolve to succeed in a nation which had been ruled by Hanoverian monarchs since 1714. In London, Johann Reinhold drew on German connections in an attempt to gain a scholarly appointment and became a regular attendant at the Society of Antiquaries and an elected fellow in early 1767. Shortly after, he was appointed tutor of modern languages and natural history at Warrington Academy, where, despite the rigorous demands of his teaching duties, he found time to further develop his interest in natural history. Forster remained at Warrington for 3 years, but became increasingly involved in translating European scientific writers, a stimulating use of his linguistic skills, which brought him growing prominence in intellectual circles. In 1770, he moved to London, and over the next 2 years, a number of his translations, including Bougainville's Voyage Around the World, appeared in print. He was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society in early 1772. Thus, Johan Reinhold Forster, Thus, Johann Rydell Forster's erudite interests and reputation as a naturalist were prominent just when, with Banks and Solander no longer prepared to sail on the Resolution, the Admiralty required a suitable replacement. Forster's name was put forward and Sandwich accepted. Johann Rydell Forster, accompanied by his 18-year-old son, George, was to join Cook's second voyage. So this is the chart which was produced after the second voyage. And really this chart makes a lot more sense when you look at charts which existed before that time, where people postulated the existence of a great south land, the Terra Australis Incognita. With this chart, you can see that great speculative continent in the south has disappeared, and what we see is the true shape there of southern Australia, southern America, and South Africa. In joining the voyage, Rydell Forster was given £4,000 to act as naturalist. Now, this money had been earmarked for James Lind, the naturalist, and had been voted by Parliament. And it was really quite a large amount of money and was to create quite some jealousies amongst other people, such as William Wales, who was the astronomer on board the vessel. As I say, the voyage was very much a voyage in difficult conditions, and one of the great things that George Forster did afterwards is to produce an essay which he called Cook der Entdecker, Cook the Discoverer, and we'll get onto that in a moment. But this is an excerpt from that essay, where he gives you some idea of the conditions. And this is all, I think, proving that he was a person who did have the qualifications. Not only had he sailed with Cook, but he'd observed Cook in these very difficult conditions, and he was a good writer. So this is Forster writing about the icebergs. Often a storm would rage, even during dark fogs. Often we did not see the sun for a fortnight or 3 weeks. Encircled by vast masses of ice which emerged from the sea like floating islands and were more dangerous because their positions would change. We often sighted them when it was almost too late to steer the ships past. How many times may we have, without even knowing it, barely escaped destruction in the dark? How often did we hear with terror the waves breaking over the ice without being able to lay our eyes on the object of our fear? We spent summer in this icy part of the world, but it was a summer when it was unusual to record the thermometer registering 1 degree above freezing. So I think that in the case of the Forsters, they had proven through going on this voyage, observing Cook, that they were very much capable of writing with authority about Cook. And the opportunity for Forster to write a commemorative piece came in 1786 when there was the opportunity to translate the official account, the official English account of the third voyage, Cook's third voyage, into German. And we have Forster now, by this stage, he'd come back from the Resolution voyage to a very unhappy welcome. Whereas John Hawkesworth had made a great deal of money out of editing and publishing the first voyage account. When the Resolution and the Adventure came back in 1775, the understanding was, or the understanding as far as Johann Rydell Forster was, that he would be given the same privilege, that it would be his job to produce the voyage account. Well, things had changed in the interim. Cook had read, he'd got his eyes onto the Hawkesworth account for the first time at the Cape of Good Hope, and he was horrified, quite frankly, by what he read. Hawkesworth had attributed many things to Cook, which Cook didn't agree with, and we get the feeling that Cook had, as the second voyage had progressed, he'd begun to think more about how he wanted to be perceived. Did he really want his words to be put out by somebody else, or did he want to have a much greater say in it? So when the vessels come back, we find there is a bit of tension occurring. And Cook basically wants to have a much greater say in that second voyage account. Initially, Reinald Forster is happy to go along with this, but gradually things start falling apart. And it gets to a point by 1776 when Lord Sandwich calls the parties together. He brings them to an official meeting where he tries to iron out the problems. And at that meeting, there is an agreement, a signed legal agreement made, whereby it's agreed that Cook will create a journal which looks at the voyage account. He'll also look at some of the ethnographic issues of the voyage. And Reinald Forster will produce a quite separate account, his observations, which will look at the scientific observations of the account. And this seems to be a line in the sand. Everybody understands where they stand at this point. The only problem occurs when Reinald Forster submits his first draft to Sandwich to read. Sandwich throws it back at him and says, "Well, you've written an enormous amount about Madeira here. This is something that everybody else and his dog has written about. This is simply not good enough. We're going to put this to an editor." And of course, Reinald Forster, a person of huge intellectual ability in his own right, took great affront at this and refused. So we have this basically this falling apart, and it gets worse the following year when, as an attempt to recover something from this, Reinald Forster has signed the legal agreement that he can't create a voyage account, but there's nothing to say that George Forster can't. And so George Forster spends 9 months writing what ultimately becomes a voyage around the world in his Britannic Majesty's vessel Resolution in the years 1772, 3, 4 and 5. An account which draws heavily, we know, on Reinhold Forster's own journal. The idea is that this will be produced and come onto the market before Cook's own account, that the Forsters will be able to recover some of their finances, and that their part in all of this wonderful voyage will be fully acknowledged. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't work out that way. Reinald Forster's account, when it comes out, only has 2 engravings in it, whereas Cook's account, when it comes out 6 weeks later, has 46 engravings. And the Admiralty makes sure that they price the Cook account so that it can compete absolutely, and it does. The both accounts come out at £2, or 2 guineas. And the Cook account is a bestseller. It sells out in a very short time at all, indeed, to the point where the bookseller who is marketing this, he writes that it's a great pity that it wasn't sold for its proper price, because, of course, he would have made a great deal of money out of it. There's a great deal of acrimony which follows this, and George Forster ultimately gets into a battle with William Wales. William Wales accuses his father of being the real voice behind the voyage, which I think to some extent is true, and accuses Forster of intellectual piracy, all sorts of things. So there are various public debates, public printed papers that go back, William Wales's remarks on Forster's account. Then we have a reply to William Wales' remarks on Forster's. And finally, we have an open letter, which is the final piece in this, where George Forster writes to Lord Sandwich openly, saying, just pointing out all of the ways in which he and his father's work has been undermined by the way this second voyage account has been produced. So very much you can see that there's a fair bit of ammunition here why Forster should not particularly like Sandwich, why he might have a grudge against Douglas, who ultimately became the editor of Cook's second voyage account, and certainly had a problem with Sandwich. So in 1776, Forster has the opportunity to translate the third voyage account into German, and he takes that opportunity in his introduction to try and right some of these wrongs. And that is when he writes that he found John Douglas's introduction intolerable. Well, some of the things he found intolerable in that account were that Douglas really draws very heavily on people like William Wales. There are great slabs of Wales's comments reproduced, whereas there are absolutely no references, or one reference in a footnote, to the work of the Forsters. And Douglas is also, in his account, he very much is careful to provide a proper tenor. So he talks about the various voyages which had preceded Cook's, the voyages by Byron and Wallace and Carteret, and also talks about the great stimulation of George III to all of these voyages of discovery. So it's a very corporate view, if you like, which comes out in this introduction. And although Cook is held up as being a person who removed any speculation about what continents might exist in the Southern Ocean, it's a fairly ordinary commemorative piece to Cook. And so George Forster, in his introduction, goes about in a very different way. Forster is very much trying to create a commemorative piece for Captain Cook. It's got very little to do with George III, and we have this wonderful essay, Cook de Entdecker. Yeah. Okay. So I'll just read a couple of pieces. One of the wonderful things I think about the Cook de Entdecker piece is that the biography, the official biography of Cook came out in 1788, and this essay on Cook precedes it by 12 months. And the official account when it came out, produced by Andrew Kippis, was, again, a very corporate affair. Again, it draws on huge slabs from other sources, large pieces of Hawkesworth, large pieces of the Second Voyage account, and ultimately it's a very unsatisfying affair. But it ultimately became the stereotype which existed right through until J.C. Beaglehole's Life of Cook appeared in the 1970s. And unfortunately, Cook de Entdecker for many years has remained in German. Michael Hoare wrote an essay on it in 1969, and one of the projects that I've been involved with recently with Horden House is we have done a translation of this, and that will be appearing as the sixth in the Australian Maritime series, to be published shortly before Christmas. The thing which I think gives Forster's image of Cook great validity is his lyrical writing, and what we see is a Cook, an off-duty Cook, if you like, a Cook with some of the warts. So here we have an example of some of this writing. The anchor was cast at the predetermined spot. The sails were furled and the boats once again manned to try and find out what the land would yield. The first object of inquiry from the natives was a convenient spot where the empty water casks could be filled with fresh drinking water. A pantomime was necessary at such times until one had learnt the most important words of the vernacular. On the beach itself... I have to say, every time I read this, I think of Greg. On the beach itself, where the natives would gather in great numbers, one was often occupied for days learning the language, observing people who are so different from ourselves, and with bartering for their clothing, weapons, ornaments, and other artefacts. We studied their way of life by repeated visits to their huts, and with gifts and small signs of affection, we gradually gained the rights of friendship to an ever greater degree, and could study the interior of the houses, their implements and their food, and its preparation. Sometimes we learned very little, but every day we learned something new. We began to observe how work was assigned, clothes were made, fields were tilled, and huts or canoes built. At other moments, we had the opportunity to witness some remarkable custom or interesting custom. At other times, one unexpectedly found a fellow who was able to talk about the genesis of his gods and about creation. In each country, minerals had to be collected, and the native birds, insects, and reptiles had to be patiently stalked the flowers of trees and plants would not keep, and so the botanists were forced to hurry back on board to complete their descriptions and illustrations before returning to the shore. So I think in terms of the collection we have out on display today, what George Forster in Cook to Entdecker adds to that is these wonderful cameo images of what was going on at the time that these artefacts are being collected. And in terms, as I say, of the total image that we have of Cook, I think that J.C. Beaglehole did as much as he could, but of course Beaglehole always rued the fact that one of the great sources who would have had information, Elizabeth Cook, who outlived Captain Cook by 57 years, in the later years of her life, very carefully destroyed any of the personal papers, the letters which had gone between her husband and herself. So what we are left with, really, Beaglehole did all the legwork, created huge documentary invoices of inventories of where the material was, but finally we're left still, to some extent, with a two-dimensional Cook. I think George Forster's account helps us greatly to soften that a little. And I know I'm going over time, so I'll just flick through the last of these images. These are some of the images. This one particularly from that second voyage, Possession Bay, down in South Georgia. The wonderful image of Cook by Hodges. Of course, Hodges was one who had sailed with Cook on that second voyage again. And I think that personal information, personal knowledge of Cook really comes out in that image. Of course, we've had a need to remember Cook ever after, and this is a typical mid-19th century Staffordshire figure of Cook, frozen in time. And we also have this continuing image of Cook going to live with the gods, something that people felt comfortable with rather than the reality of his real death in Hawaii. And of course in Hawaii they take a far more liberal view of Cook these days. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.